Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Paul Lawrence, the co-chairman of the IBM Endowment for the Business of Government. We created the endowment in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. Find out more about the endowment by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. The Business of Government Hour features a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. Our conversation this morning is with Dr. David Chu, Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness for the Department of Defense. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Paul.
And joining us in our conversation is Bill Phillips. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Bill, how are you?
Good.
Well, David, what's the mission of the Office of the Undersecretary for Personnel and Readiness?
We're the people of the department. That is to say, we manage everything ranging from what the pay table is going to look like for military personnel through the healthcare system that provides for them and their families, all the way through to questions overseeing the readiness of our units in terms of the training that they get and where they get that training and how it's going to be conducted.
And how does it fit in the overall mission of the department?
People, as you all, I think, appreciate, are the heart of the department. And, of course, there are a lot of people. We have about 3.5 million people when you count the active reserve and civil force department in terms of the direct employee workforce of the department. And without those people, without quality people who are well-trained, well-motivated to do the kind of job that the nation needs, there really isn't a military. So this is the heart of the department's capacity to fulfill the nation's needs.
David, as the Undersecretary for Personnel and Readiness, what are your specific duties?
My job is really to set policy within the framework that the Congress provides by its statutes and consistent with the administration's aims and agenda. Now, in some cases, we'll go back to the Congress and ask for a change of policy. But to give an example, we supervise the healthcare system for the military. We buy somewhat over half of the healthcare services that our people need from the private sector. We have certain big contracts through which this is managed. In fact, at this very moment, we're rebidding those contracts. And so my job is to set the parameters that are going to describe those contracts. How many regions are we going to have? How many contracts are we going to pursue? What degree of competition should we aim for? What's going to be the nature of those contracts? What are going to be the incentives that those contracts contain? I don't actually run the programs myself. The office doesn't run the programs directly, but it may administer the programs, or it may administer the agency that actually carries out the task at hand. That's an example, again, from the healthcare sector. We have the so-called TRICARE management activity that actually runs the contracts for us.
Tell us about your career prior to this appointment.
Well, I've spent most of my life in and around the Defense Department in some fashion. I came in as a young Army officer during the Vietnam War. I got my chance to visit Southeast Asia, as every Army person, I think, in that era got to do. And coming out of that experience, I looked around and was fortunate enough to be hired by RAND, which is a research corporation headquartered in Santa Monica, California. And quite by accident, I started working on military manpower questions. I was originally trained as an international trade and development economist. But this was the focus of a great deal of attention, this question of military manpower, in the early 1970s, because as you remember, the country had made a decision to go to a volunteer force. Big experiment. No one had ever attempted to put together this big a military composed completely of volunteers before. The British had a volunteer force, much smaller scale. And so the Department of Defense engaged RAND, among others, to help it think through how we're going to make this successful, how we're going to make this work. And it was a big challenge. And you may remember some of those years in the 70s, the volunteer force didn't do so well at first. In fact, almost failed, partly because they set the pay numbers wrong in the mid-1970s. And the quality levels of the force fell. And in fact, fell further than people managing the Department of Defense understood to be the case, because they'd made a technical mistake. They had misnormed the so-called vocational aptitude battery test, the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery Test, the ASVAB. And the managers thought they were getting reasonably qualified people, maybe not quite the level they'd like to have. The sergeants kept saying, you know, these people aren't like the ones we used to get. They just aren't very good. Turned out the sergeants were right. Turned out they were taking in large numbers of people only marginally qualified for military service by mistake in the mid-1970s. Congress reacted to all this by setting standards for the military in terms of the quality of recruits enlisted in the military. And part of RAND's job was to help the military and said, okay, if these are the standards, how are we going to get from here to there? How are we going to make this successful? I came to work in Washington in 1978 at the Congressional Budget Office, where I ran the section responsible for national security issues broadly. And I was invited by the Reagan administration to become the what's called the Director of Program Analysis and Evaluation, which is the sort of inside think tank in the Pentagon. It's there to advise the secretary on choices, on alternatives. In some ways, it's the black hat of the department. Your job is to be the secretary's set of intellectual shock troops to advance new ideas, ideas that may not be popular. In fact, generally aren't popular, but later come to be received wisdom. I'll take an example. One of the issues we took on in that period of time is who should conduct the air defense mission in the United States. In that era, it was really an air sovereignty mission. In other words, an airliner comes to the United States inappropriately, who goes up and checks it out kind of thing. And it was being done by active Air Force units, even though it was a mission that we thought could be done equally well and at somewhat less expense by reserve companies, Air Guard, Air Reserve units. And you would have thought that we were heretics for raising this possibility that the reserve components could do this. Well, after a long battle, the Air Force grudgingly agreed to try out using more reserve component crews for this purpose. And of course, quite ironic, I came back to the department having been there from 81 to 93, came back in 2001 to discover we now had, at that time, all the air defense being conducted by reserve company. So part of your job in that post is to get new ideas tried, get them advanced, get people to look at them. I served in that post for almost 12 years, left as administration, left office in January 93, Bush 41, as people call it, and returned to Rand as it turned out. I worked in Rand's Washington office, which I was the head of for a while, and then later ran one of Rand's major units, the Arroyo Center, which is the unit that advises the Army. And then I was invited by the present administration to come back in the post I now hold in June of 2001.
Given that career, what made you decide that you wanted to come back this time?
I have always found public service extremely rewarding. I recognize financially often people take a significant step down in income to take these positions. But the psychic rewards, the sense of contribution that one gets, and the opportunity to help the nation do its business is tremendous compensation. It gives you a tremendously good feeling about what you're doing with your life. And so it's that more than anything else that I think makes public service attractive. Of course, the Defense Department, as I think you know, is a great place to work. It's a terrific set of people, highly motivated, very mission-oriented. I'm struck. Paul Light did a survey of federal employees recently. You may have seen this piece of research. And while we have our faults, and he pointed some of those out, nonetheless, he was really struck by the degree to which morale in the Defense Department was not only good, but getting better over time after the events of September 11th because it's so mission-focused. And it's just a great set of people to work with. There's a real sense of a community, a real sense of pulling together, common purpose. And of course, in some sense, defending the country and its interest is the ultimate public service, the ultimate reason one has a central government.
It's interesting that you mentioned that it's such a great place to work because the Department of Defense is the largest of the federal government agencies. And I'm just wondering, with things of that scale, how do you communicate? How do you do the traditional management functions on the size?
Well, you use every instrument at your disposal, including programs like this, obviously. part of it is just very straightforward. It's a bit like Woody Hayes and 3 yards straight up the middle. You write the memos, you make the announcements. More important, I think, is getting out and talking to people. If not face-to-face, at least in some way that they can ask you questions. And they can express their concerns. I'm struck that many of the problems of the Defense Department, I think it's true of any large bureaucracy, arise from miscommunication. As the military would like to say, what's the commander's intent? What are we trying to do here? What are we trying to accomplish? And why do we pick this way of getting to that goal? And I'm impressed at the power of just sitting down and talking with people. And of course, in an organization that large, a lot of what you need to do is talk to the leaders of subordinate units to convey to them, what are we trying to accomplish here? Why do we choose this method? And of course, even better to have talked to them before you've made a choice. To engage them in thinking through how might we solve this problem, how might we address this issue, And I have always found that if you can get the leaders together like this, you may come in the room with no idea what to do about the problem at hand. And I'm impressed the number of times you leave the room with the outline of an answer, with a framework within which you can proceed, because each person has contributed his or her particular insight. And so I find the meeting, I know people laugh a bit about meetings as being the bane of bureaucracy. Actually, I find the meeting extremely productive. And the sort in the tasks I have to be responsible for, a terrific way to get people together to explain what we have to do and to get them to help tell us what a solution might look like.
That's a good stopping point. Rejoin us in a few minutes as we continue our conversation with David Chu of the Department of Defense. Human capital transformation is a key part of the President's management agenda. What's the Department's plan to address human resource issues? We'll ask David when the Business of Government Hour returns.